Well, we'd like to welcome you to the 63rd Scripture Roundtable of the Interpreter Foundation. This one is dedicated to Lesson 13 in the 2014 Gospel Doctrine Lesson Manual, Bondage, Passover, and Exodus. So we're basically concentrating on the story of the bondage of the Israelites in Egypt, their exodus from Egypt, and their the beginning of their progress, very slow, toward the Promised Land. This is one of the grandest stories, one of the most fundamentally important stories in Scripture. It's a story that all subsequent prophets and writers refer to in one way or another. It's a metaphor of deliverance that's been used in liberation struggles around the world. It's been used by American slaves in their spirituals, just everywhere. Now, given the grandness, I was a little bit dismayed when I finally, years ago, made it to Greece and discovered that the ordinary exit sign over every door leading out of the airport was Exodus. It seemed a little prosaic after the grand associations of Exodus, because Exodus simply means going out. That's all it means, exit. Our word exit comes from that. But there's much more to it than that. And oh, I should identify who I'm here with. I am Dan Peterson, and I have with me Ben McGuire and Mike Parker. And I believe, Mike, that you wanted to say something about the name of the book.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right, Dan. Our English word exodus comes from Greek, meaning departure or outgoing. It came from Greek into Latin, and then it passed into English from there. In Hebrew, though, the book is not known as going out. The books of the Torah, the five books of Moses, are the names in Hebrew are given based on the opening phrase in each book. So in this case, the opening phrase of the book is, and these are the names, and that's what they refer to it in Hebrew. Excuse me, I'm not very good at my pronunciation. Ve'ele Shemoth. These are the names, or simply Shemoth, names. Want to talk a little bit about dating the Exodus. This is the first book of the Bible that we can really attempt to date with any reasonable certainty. Everything before this is kind of lost to prehistory. It's really important to understand. We kind of, in American or Western culture, have this view of Egypt as being the sort of monolithic culture throughout history, that it always looked the same, that it always looked like Yul Brynner and you know, the Luxor Casino in Las Vegas, which is actually not the case. Egypt had a 4,000-year history, and there were many different periods, the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, the New Kingdom, and intermediate periods where the country was waxed and waned in its cultural significance and what groups were ruling it. Basically, it comes down to there are two proposed chronologies for the Exodus. There's an early date before 1440 BC, and then there's a later date between 1250 and 1200. At the beginning of the book, it talks about Joseph and all his generation grew old and died, and then the Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, is what the text says. And this new Pharaoh enslaved the children of Israel, and the trick is to identify who this new king is from Exodus 1, verse 8. And we honestly don't know, because we don't know the timing on this. However, one theory, and this is the late theory, is that it was the Pharaoh Ramses II, because his name is actually mentioned in the book of Exodus by a city name. And if that's the case, Ramses II would be on the throne and oppressing Israel when Moses was born, and possibly his son would have been on the throne when Moses returns. And that would have been his successor, Merneptah, who reigned between 1213 and 1203. So that's for the later date. What's really interesting about Merneptah is that, and actually a stela that was discovered, or a stone carving with Egyptian lettering in it, that was discovered in 1896, which indicates that at the bottom of it, that the quote says, "Israel is wasted bare of seed, or perhaps Israel is wasted, its seed is no longer. And that could be an argument that Israel was already established as a nation, and perhaps the Exodus took place earlier than that. It could also be a political statement that perhaps the Israelites went out of Egypt, and so to make it look like this was really a stunning Egyptian victory, they put this thing about how awful things are in, for the people of Israel. So again, we don't really know precisely when the date is, but we're kind of starting to get into that area where we can put some wide boundaries. So between about 1200 all the way back as far as maybe 1440, 1450 BC is our, kind of our bookends for this era.
Okay. Ben, did you have anything you wanted to say about this first chapter? I just summarized. This is the chapter, of course, that talks about the children of Israel multiplying, placed in bondage by Egyptians, and then Pharaoh seeks to destroy sons born to Hebrew women.
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that we see, in at least in these early parts in the book of Exodus, is that it's put together with, very much with kind of a plan. Here in chapter 1, we have a lot of the language of creation for Israel. And, of course, for Israel, the issue is we're stuck here in bondage, but we have all these blessings promised to us through Abraham. How do we go from where we're at in bondage to fulfilling the work of creation, extending the work of creation and fulfilling those promises given to Abraham? And so Israel is this creative force, and Pharaoh represents this anti-creation. He's creating chaos, and he does this through a series of ordered events in which Israel is oppressed, right? We start with the extra work that they're given. We move on to this trying to destroy Israel through its children, right? In fact, verse 16 of chapter 1, and I found this kind of interesting because in our King James text it says, "And he said, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew woman and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live." And based on a little bit later where it talks about when the women come back and say, well, we didn't get rid of any of them because we couldn't tell, or we got there too late. We have this translational difficulty because of the word that's translated, the stools, is actually the word that means a potter's wheel. And currently there's this belief that that may be a metaphor for the Egyptian god Khnum, who creates humanity on a potter's wheel, forms them at conception, shapes them as clay, and gives them their form. And so the idea is that the midwives would practice their craft and determine in a prenatal exam whether it was a boy or a girl. And then if it was a boy, they were supposed to terminate the pregnancy. And when they come back and say, well, we can't do it, the Israelite women are different from the Egyptian women, Pharaoh seems to accept that, right? He doesn't have a problem with it. He understands this. And then Pharaoh moves on to the next stage, which is simply, well, kill the boys when they're born, right? Don't bother with worrying about it ahead of time. So we have this progression, and it gets worse and worse and worse, this escalating violence against the Hebrews. Now, I want to just mention one other quick thing, and I think this is really fascinating because there's a certain irony here. Mike mentioned that the Hebrew name of the book is the book of these are the names, right? That's the title.
These are the names.
Hebrew. Exodus 2, and you actually have to look at this, so it's good to open it up and take a look if you're watching the podcast here, but Exodus chapter 2 is remarkable because of its anonymity. "And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to a wife a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bare a son." And we all know who that son is, right? His name is Moses, but it's not here in the story yet. And then we go through the other characters here. His sister, a daughter of Pharaoh, right? Her maidens. The sister to Pharaoh's daughter, right? A nurse of the Hebrew women. we go down through this list of the characters, and it continues even through Moses' father-in-law and so on. In a sense, as we read this, we see, we get a feeling almost of dehumanization in the narrative, right? Pharaoh in Egypt is doing these things to destroy Israel. He's dehumanizing them, and that comes out in the narrative. And it almost certainly has to be intentional in a book that starts off talking about the names, right? Everybody is faceless and has no name. And then as we get into it now, we start to see the names of these people. But we get Moses, and only we find out Moses after he leaves, right? After he's killed the nameless Egyptian oppressor and the bickering Israelites who have no name, right? Only as he goes through this process does he start to create an identity. And in a sense, this brings us to this scene where then God talks to Moses and God reveals his name, right? It makes it much more of a personal interaction. And here, in all of this, we see a Moses who we're bringing out his Moses' traits, his divine traits, right? He's going to be a God to the people. He's going to be a prophet. He's going to be doing all this stuff. And in contrast, we're bringing out the humanity of God, who is suffering with his people, who is emotionally attached and emotionally involved in the Israelites and what's going on with them in this dehumanization process that the Egyptians are putting them through. It is this role reversal that really binds us into the story and catches us and draws us right in. It's a wonderful thing.
You know, you mentioned the lack of names. You also mentioned the idea that this is kind of an anti-creation, that Pharaoh is attempting to undo things to do with the creation. Think of God's acts in the creations. He's constantly not only creating things, but naming things. That's an important part of the creation, is to literally, to in a sense, to define things by giving them names, setting the darkness off from the light, the earth from the sea, and so on. And here things aren't named. So,
right. I mean, I really think that it's portraying this return to chaos in this theological sense, and really for the Israelites, a very real sense, right? Their world is being turned upside down.
Right. Well, looks like we're moving into chapter 2. Mike, is there anything else you wanted to say about chapter 1 before we move on?
Nope.
Okay. Then, of course, in chapter 2, we have the account of Moses' birth to Levitical or Levite parents. He's raised by Pharaoh's daughter, which is a little unusual and unexpected. In defense of an Israelite, he slays an Egyptian. He flees to Midian, marries Zipporah, and then Israel in bondage cries to the Lord. The people are familiar, I think, basically with the narrative here. We were commenting before we began recording this how we just can't begin to do justice to this story. It is so rich, and there's so many details to comment on. It's played such a role in the cultural history of not only the West, but the Islamic world. This is a story that has resonated down the years, and is of course still ritually reenacted in a sense in Passover rituals, and derivatively in a sense in the Mass and in the LDS sacrament. And you know, there are all kinds of echoes of the story. The story about the hiding of Moses in the bulrushes and putting him in this little ark. A little boat or a basket. A similar story is told about Sargon the Great, the Mesopotamian king from probably 1,000 years earlier. So this is a motif that is not absolutely new with the Moses story. Some people have pointed to that as proof that it lacks historicity, but I don't see it as being very compelling. In fact, it's not clear to me that that the author of Exodus would have even known the story of Sargon the Great from a millennium earlier, a different language, and so on. But but then you have Pharaoh's daughter down by the river, sees the baby, in effect adopts him, but also takes Moses' actual mother along as the wet nurse for the baby. Mike, I think you wanted to say something about the name Moses.
Speaking of names, which Ben spoke so eloquently about a few minutes ago, Moses, the word in Hebrew is actually a wordplay. Moshe, the Hebrew mashah, which sounds a lot like Moshe, it means to draw out. And that's significant not only because Moses was himself drawn out of the water by Pharaoh's daughter, but his name foretells the future calling to deliver Israel by drawing them out of Egypt. Now, what would his name been in Egyptian? Clearly, he's found by an Egyptian woman. He's not going to be given a Hebrew name. He's going to be given an Egyptian name. It's probably something along the lines of, it's difficult to tell, but it's probably something along the lines of born of, which would be the letters MS in Egyptian. The Egyptians worship the river Nile as a god, the source of all life. So it makes sense then that Pharaoh's daughter would have believed that Moses was born out of the Nile, that he's a son of the Nile. So his name would have indicated as such. We see something similar to that in the name Ramses, which means right. born of Ra, who was right. the Egyptian sun god. So his name has meaning, and this is what's interesting, the story is his name has meaning both for Egyptians, for Pharaoh's daughter and the household that he's raised in, but it also has deep meaning for the Israelites, whom he is going to draw out of Egypt.
Right. You see that name element in a lot of royal names, Mes, Ramesses, Tutmos, Ahmos. There are a lot of pharaohs who are born of this or that god. Tutmos is born of the god Thoth, scribal god. And others like that. So, yeah, it's a bilingual pun, I guess, in some ways. And
not too easy to pull off, is it?
No. But then, of course, Moses finds a way of alienating himself from Pharaoh's court, or becoming persona non grata around the pharaonic court, and has to go into exile. And he goes into the land of Midian. Now, Midian is pretty much universally, I think, recognized as being today in what is now called Saudi Arabia. It would be across the Gulf of Aqaba, or the Gulf of Eilat, from what we now know as the Sinai Peninsula. And as a matter of fact, there are those who argue that even the true Mount Sinai is actually over in Midian, not in the Sinai Peninsula. No one really knows. There's nothing to prove it one way or the other, but the clear fact is that the Israelites themselves don't seem to have known where it was after a certain period. They don't make it an object of pilgrimage or anything like that. So it may well be that the whole thing is over. Just it's not very far. I mean, when I say it's in Saudi Arabia, people may react, and I don't know that it was, but they may react and say, oh, but that's a long way away. Actually, it's not. It's just across a fairly narrow little gulf of water. On a clear day, standing in the Sinai, you can see Saudi Arabia. And it might just be over there. But that, of course, happens to be a very good place for Moses to go into the land of Midian. It's going to change his life. He encounters some people over there with whom he will become aligned by marriage. And Latter-day Saints believe that Jethro actually plays an even more important role than that, this is a man who had some form of priesthood or something like that. Moses marries into the family. And eventually Pharaoh dies, the Pharaoh of Moses' youth, and he's replaced by a new one. And the oppression, if anything, gets even worse. And so it says that God looked upon the children of Israel. God had respect unto them. And the word really is that he was cognizant of them. He was aware of them. He remembered his obligations or his hopes for them. Anything else about chapter 2?
That word remembered is very important. It shows up quite a bit in the Old Testament, or particularly in the first five books, in a covenant sense. It shows up especially in Genesis chapter 7, verse 1, which is really the turning point of the story of Noah, where Noah has been out on the waters for, you know, months at this point, and then it says in Genesis 7, verse 1, that God remembered Noah.
Yeah.
Now, it's not like God was preoccupied, that he got distracted by something And then he goes, oh, Noah, wait a minute, what about him?
Yeah.
That's not what it means. What it means is, in a covenant sense, God remembered the promises that he had made to Noah and to Enoch, through whom Noah was a descendant, and the promises to Enoch were given to Noah. This word remembered here that shows up toward the end of chapter 2, it means it in the same way, that in chapter 2, verse 24, that God hears their groaning, and God remembers his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God, as we all know, keeps his covenants. He's not going to break his bond and his word. And so now it's to call out someone who can deliver his people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I was just going to... I actually think in some ways that, particularly in the Noah story, right, there is this overtone of forgetfulness. God is reminded... and I think that maybe that's just a way of people of explaining why it is that they're stuck there, right?
Yeah.
How could God leave us here to suffer all of this? We had to come to him and remind him
right.
of his promises. I'm not sure that the one view or the other is bad, because I'm not sure that we're supposed to learn anything from this. It becomes kind of the prop for the reason why God introduces is reintroduced into the story, right? And all of a sudden the story changes direction.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb, Horeb being apparently an alternative name for Mount Sinai. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will not turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. When it talks about the angel of the Lord being there, appearing unto him in the flame of fire out of the midst of a bush, it's pretty clear in other contexts that the angel of the Lord here is actually the Lord himself. Sometimes the term the angel of the Lord, as with the pillar of fire that comes a little bit later, is used to refer to the Lord himself in some sort of physical presence, or a localized appearance. He's not just everywhere or vaguely somewhere. He's in a specific place. You know, it strikes me about the burning bush, we sometimes call it. That's kind of a misnomer, because the point is the bush isn't burning. it's actually not burning at all. That's not the freakish thing. Yeah. So I've wondered sometimes, well, what was that? Kind of an odd prop. Then it occurred to me, you know, there was a book by Barbara Tuchman, I think, many years ago, called "A World Lit Only by Fire." It was about the 14th century, you know, pre-electricity. Well, this was certainly a world lit only by fire too. And for any kind of bright light, the only explanation they had was fire. I just think, you know, it may or may not have had anything to do with actual flames. Maybe it did. I'm not saying it didn't, but. But it was a bright, bright light that caught his attention, and that was the only kind of light he knew. Moses would know, or any of his contemporaries, would be fire. And it reminds me of the description of Joseph Smith. One of his descriptions of the first vision is this pillar of fire, he says, was coming down upon him. He expected it to catch the trees on fire when it touched them. He was actually terrified of that, and it didn't. Well, we might have said, because again, Joseph lived in a world lit only by fire, we might have just described it as light, but they knew no light separate from fire on the whole. Brilliant light, but not necessarily flames.
Same description for Lehi too, right?
Yeah.
The pillar of fire that dwelt on the rock.
Yeah.
There's no bush there, but it is the same image.
Right.
I think meant to lead us to that, to draw that connection.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, the fact is it's an intensely brilliant light of a kind that an ancient person has never seen. I'm not sure that we've seen it either, but we have some other analogies to it that they lacked. So to them it's flame, fire, something like that. Or the flames that appear at Pentecost. Were they really flames? I don't know. But brilliant light, in any event. And that we know from other descriptions of encounters with angels and the divine, that this brilliant light that's actually in some ways intimidating, and yet doesn't destroy. So it might even, if you really got wild, you can even read accounts of it in near-death stories. People are just astonished at the light that they think would destroy their eyes or their sight, but doesn't. Okay, so he steps aside, and here's a voice, Moses, Moses. And he said, "Here am I." And then he's told not to come too close and to put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Now, I take it that it doesn't mean intrinsically holy in any way. It's holy now because God is there. It's sanctified by his presence. Before that, it was just an ordinary spot of desert ground with a bush. Incidentally, I've seen the burning bush at the monastery of St. Catherine in Sinai. They have a really dirty little window that you can look through, and I've looked in it, and I'm clearly a person of no faith because I've never even been able to see the bush. It just looks dark to me. But it's in there, the actual bush. Okay, and then he identifies himself as, "I'm the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Pretty much the common reaction. This is not just a person in a white robe with a bright light shining on him. This is something more scary than that. And then he tells him that, "I've seen your afflictions, and I've come down to deliver your people." Any comments about this story in Exodus 3?
I have a few. In chapter 3, verse 13, Moses asks God a question. He says, "When I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers have sent me unto you,' and they say unto me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say unto them?" And it's an interesting question because Moses is probably anticipating that the Israelites would want to be sure that Moses came with a message from their God, from the true God. It presumes that they would have known his name and that they would have known the ways that he had manifested himself and would have been able to properly identify Moses as a true prophet. And that wouldn't do any good for Moses to come with a new name for God. That would be like introducing him to a new God. And then the Lord answers him, "I am," in verse 14, chapter 3, "I am that I am. Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you. Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Jehovah, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial unto all generations." And that phrase, "I am," in Hebrew, is a cognate of the Hebrew verb to be.
Right.
When God used the verb to express his name, he's using it in this form to say, "I am," or I am. It's just simply, "I exist. I am the one." It's an excellent wordplay on the divine name of Jehovah, which is just simply four letters in Hebrew, YHWH, probably pronounced Yahweh anciently. It's kind of a complicated story how it ended up being Jehovah, but basically it comes from Hebrew and then through Latin and then to English.
The one thing we're sure of is it cannot be Jehovah.
It can't be, yeah. There's no hard J and right. And then that sort of thing. But the word or the name Jehovah or Yahweh is the third person masculine singular form of the same verb, he is. And this verb has a very active quality about it. The Lord is eternal. He's continually present with his people. He fulfills all of his promises. And then we see later on Jesus using that phrase at the end of John chapter 8. He uses that powerful phrase, "I am." Before Abraham was, I am, and he uses it with deep significance, for which the unbelieving Jews of his day attempted to stone him for blasphemy.
Right. Right.
And then it also shows up later in the Doctrine and Covenants in three locations, starting with section 29, verse 1, where Jesus is identified as the I am. So that's a very significant name.
Yeah. The Israelites or the Jews who hear Jesus say it, you know, immediately get the point. You know, why are we going to stone you? Because thou being a man, makest thou thyself equal unto God.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's used that term very deliberately. And they don't miss the point. That is an extraordinarily rich passage. And, you know, people have written for literally thousands of years, a couple of thousand years at least, about that divine name and the description, "I am that I am," and "I am." Well, he sends Moses into Egypt. and tells him that he's to tell the king of Egypt to let the Israelites go. He also tells him, I'm quite confident that he won't do it. So you're going to have your work cut out for you, but I'm the one who's going to do it, really. I will stretch out my hand, verse 20 of chapter 3, and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go.
And Dan, there's some interesting passages in there where it talks about the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yes.
Now, we have a hard time with that, of course, as Latter-day Saints, because we are believers in agency and that God is not going to force us or even tempt us to do evil. And the Joseph Smith translation attempts to correct that by saying that Pharaoh hardened his heart, that it was Pharaoh's responsibility. The way that it's played up in the original version, though, and I'm not saying that the Joseph Smith translation is necessarily wrong, but I would not say that that one has to be right and the other one wrong. I think they're right. Coming from two separate theological traditions. The Joseph Smith translation is reinforcing a Latter-day Saint concept that we're each agents to ourselves. But the original is really reinforcing the concept that Pharaoh, even in his evil ways, is carrying out God's plan, that God has done this on purpose to make it hard for the Israelites to come out of Egypt. He doesn't want it to be easy for them. He doesn't want them to just go, oh, okay, you can leave, and then they walk out.
Yeah.
This is going to become the foundational story for their entire religion and culture and worship for thousands of years. He wants to make it as hard as possible for them so that even down to today, where we are, over 3,000 years later, this story is still told every year at Passover. And the only way that this could be accomplished is if you have...
We've lost him a little bit there. Well, one thing I'll say is that it's a very good pose, though. One thing it does is it puts Pharaoh in God's hands. Pharaoh is putty in God's hands. Pharaoh doesn't harden his heart in this reading of it. God hardens his heart. Pharaoh is God, right? I mean, he's a God to his people. He's supposed to be divine. And one of the things that we have here is judgment on his arrogance.
And we contrast that idea of Pharaoh as God, right, in his own mind, with this lengthy, drawn-out process where Pharaoh makes concession after concession, but tries to hold on to his own will.
Yeah.
Only to finally have it thwarted in the end, and the revelation that even Pharaoh, as great as he is nothing compared to God and God's will. I also think that we have this issue here in that Israel, and this is part of the story later on, Israel wants to go back to Egypt, right?
Right.
But the way that their exit occurs really kind of makes that a non-starter from the get-go,
yes.
Right? And I think that this is partly intentional. We have to break the people away from Egypt in a way that prevents them from going back. And this is part of this story that's very important, even as it's carried out again and again and again, right?
Yeah.
When the Latter-day Saints have their own exodus out west, they're not going to go back.
Right.
When Lehi and Nephi leave their Egypt, which is Jerusalem, right? They get on a boat and sail across the ocean. This isn't a one-way journey. So I think that there's some of that, those same tones, that part of the story comes out pretty clearly because of the way these events occur.
Yeah, I think it does. Okay, so the Lord sends Moses into Egypt. He gives him some things that he can do. He shows him some miracles, the kind of power that he's going to accompany him with, turning his hand, in effect, leprous, and then restoring it to health, for example. But he goes to Pharaoh, and he has these adventures with him. Chapter 5, afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, because, of course, Aaron has come along with Moses as his spokesman. Moses being slow of speech, as he puts it, he has a speech impediment maybe, or just not confident in public speaking. We got Mike back, good. He told Pharaoh, verse 1 of chapter 5, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go. Now, You've heard that phrase before. I can almost begin to hum it. That they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness. And Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? You have the arrogance of Pharaoh on full display there. Who is Yahweh? Who? Yeah, I don't care. And it contrasts really nicely, I think, with the response of Moses. I noticed this just tonight. In verse 11 of chapter 3, when Moses is told, I'll send thee unto Pharaoh that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt, describing what he's going to do, about the same thing that Moses then says to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's response is, who is Yahweh? Who is the Lord that I should obey him? Moses' response in chapter 3, verse 11 is, Moses said unto God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh? It's an expression of humility, you know. My word, me? Are you kidding? And by contrast, Pharaoh's is an expression of arrogance. Who is God? Who is Jehovah? Who is Yahweh? I don't care. I don't need to obey him. I am the divine God, King of Egypt. And so we're going to see here a lesson in humility given to Pharaoh, very decisively so. Mike, do you have anything you want to say? You took a little vacation from us there.
Yeah, my internet connection is being weird tonight. Sorry. No, I think we're good. We can press on.
Okay. So he asked for this permission to go out and sacrifice in the desert. Pharaoh is not particularly impressed with the request and doesn't grant it. In fact, he makes things worse. He lays heavier burdens on the Israelites. They're not given the straw with which to make brick, but the quota of bricks they're supposed to produce every day is not reduced. So their workload has been increased. And I think, Ben, you had something to say about that idea of going out into the desert and sacrificing.
Where I want to start really is just to talk about this next section, and we're all kind of familiar with it. We have the 10 plagues that are going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And there's actually a structure to it. We get two plagues that come with a warning, and then we get the third plague with no warning, and that's usually the one that has the most impact, right? And then we get three more, and then finally we get the last one, which doesn't fit the pattern, but it's the one that really changes things. Pharaoh is going to deny this request for them to go out into the wilderness. And one thing I think it's important for us to know is that we are so familiar with this story, we often read more into it than it is really meant for us to experience, right? Nowhere in all of this material, up until chapter 14, which is at the very end of our lesson today, does Moses ever hint to Pharaoh that the people are leaving Egypt and not coming back. And for Pharaoh, this is going to be completely nowhere on his mind either, right? You don't take 3 million people out into the wilderness, into the desert.
Yeah.
The big threat that the Egyptians worry about from the Israelites is that they'll be invaded by somebody else and the Israelites will help the enemy, right? Suddenly you've got 3 million more soldiers, which would overwhelm any army. So the concern isn't that they're going to leave. It's just a matter of continuing this attack, this violence against the Israelites is really the backdrop here. So we get to the third plague, and after the third plague, Pharaoh has a change of heart, right? He's going to let them go. But he says to Moses, he says, you don't need to leave. You can offer your sacrifices here in Egypt. Everybody will be happy. And this is in 8:26, Moses responds. He says, it's not meet to do so, for we shall sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God. Lo, shall we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, and will they not stone us? A way to interpret that really might be something like, could we sacrifice the sacred animals of the Egyptians in front of them and not expect them to stone us, right? There's this contrast between their religious values here and the way that they perform their sacrifices and the rest of their stuff. So Moses reasserts that they need to take the 3-day trip into the wilderness, right? And finally Pharaoh agrees to this. And Moses says, good, we'll get ready to go in the morning. The plague will be lifted and we'll be on our way. In the morning, the plague is lifted. And Pharaoh changes his mind. which starts this next sequence of plagues. And finally, you know, we get to the plague of locusts, right? And at this point, Pharaoh's advisors come to Pharaoh, and they say, and this is in chapter 10, verse 7, Pharaoh's servants said unto him, how long shall this man be a snare unto us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Knowest thou not yet that Egypt is destroyed? They said, Egypt is going to be destroyed if you keep this up. There's this admission that, really there's something going on here. And Pharaoh takes this kind of literally, doesn't he? He says, you can go. Only the men can go. The women and children have to stay behind in Egypt. And verse 9, Moses says, the women and children have to go with us. They participate in this feast to the Lord, right? We cannot leave them behind. The Lord wants them to go too. And again, no hint that there's anything more than this three-day trip into the desert, right, to offer sacrifice. So Pharaoh is going to let them go, and then he changes his mind again, right? And this is where we get this language that Mike talked about the Lord changing Pharaoh's mind, or Pharaoh changing his mind, right? So Pharaoh comes back after the ninth plague, the plague of darkness, and he says, okay, you can go. All your people can go. And so we're making these concessions every time, right? And what we see here is that Moses isn't negotiating, is he? Moses is saying, this is what the Lord said, this is what's going to happen, and Pharaoh says, no, we'll try this, and every time Pharaoh comes back now with more, he says, okay, all the people can go, but you have to leave your animals behind. And of course Moses comes back and he says, we don't know what the Lord is going to demand of us once we get out there, we need to take them too. And Pharaoh changes his mind again, and that's when we get the final plague, right? And
yeah.
The firstborn of all of the Egyptians are killed. And then Pharaoh says, get out of here, just go.
Yeah.
And they leave. And then something unexpected happens, because we've had this whole story about this three-day trip, and in chapter 14, verses 1 to 5, I'll start reading this a little bit, right? The Lord spake unto Moses. Now, they've already moved out. They're in the wilderness along the border of Egypt. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel that they turn and encamp before I'm going to be like the rest of you gospel doctrine teachers that are watching this. I won't be able to pronounce these words either. Pi-ha-hiroth, between Migdal and the sea, over against Baal-zephon, before it shall ye encamp by the sea. The Lord tells them to stop going into the desert where they were supposed to go, and to come back to the Reed Sea, the Sea of Reeds there. And then in verse 4, right, this is one of the ones that get changed. I will harden Pharaoh's heart that he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was turned against the people, and they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And this is a funny thing. We know why they did this, right? Did Pharaoh really have a choice? The plagues would have continued, right?
Yeah.
Until Egypt was no more. I find it just a little bit funny, but essentially, they make this change, and Pharaoh now suddenly knows that they're not going in the desert to worship God in the desert, right?
Right.
And Pharaoh also knows they haven't turned around. They are not coming back to Egypt.
Right.
They are going into the wilderness. They are leaving. And they have declared in this act of turning around their political independence from Egypt. And that's when Pharaoh becomes afraid and terrified that maybe they will come back to Egypt, but if they come back, they won't come back as slaves, right? They'll
right.
come back to try and conquer. And that's when he sends his armies out. So we get into this story, and up to this point, Moses doesn't know how God is going to take them out of Egypt. And the Israelites don't know how they're going to leave Egypt. God tells them in this moment that now you're going to have to trust me. And so this whole next scene of confrontation between the Lord and the hosts of Egypt really is to set this response so that they can have faith and trust in God when they get to the rest of this horrible journey they're about to undertake. which we cover in the next few lessons, right? Going out into the wilderness without adequate water and food and all that. And I just wanted to point out one thing, and I know that that Mike probably will have something to say about this, but we have these 3 million people. That's a conservative estimate. You know, some estimate the number to be higher based on the figures that are in there. Almost 1 million animals, 10,000 wagons. If we line this up in kind of like a caravan, and I'm not talking about single file, but a good size width of people, you would have a line more than 50 miles long. It would take a young man running 3 days to travel from the front of that column to the back. This is not a little thing. We see pictures in the news of camps of people that have been ousted because of political unrest and looked at their horrible conditions and the filth that they're in and the need for water, clean water and stuff. And so you're taking this huge group of people and their animals out into the wilderness. How do you take care of them? This is the reason why the Egyptians never envisioned them leaving, because where are you going to go? What are you going to do with all these people and the conditions you would have to go in? We have to have some way to convince the Israelites that the Lord is going to take care of them in the wilderness.
It's one of the reasons why Egypt felt and usually was so secure. It was bounded on either side by deserts that were really awful places. So the way the United States once felt secure because it had an ocean on either side. We were so far away from everybody else. Hey, we were pretty secure. Egypt had these deserts that were like inhospitable oceans. And so the idea that people would attack them was fairly remote. It happened occasionally, but not all that often. The idea that people would simply leave the fertile Nile Valley and head out in large numbers into the desert was, you just didn't do it. Nobody did it. It would be crazy to do it.
Well, all of our Old Testament narratives prior to this talk about them going to Egypt to avoid famine, right?
Right, right.
Egypt just didn't have the famines that everywhere else did.
Egypt had the regular, relatively gentle Nile flood. And, you know, anybody who's been to the Nile Valley, it's impressive. I mean, one of the places, I lived there for 4 years, and so, you know, one of the places that I always like to take people to make it clear was out by the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, just a little bit south of Cairo. There you go up onto the edge of the Nile Valley, and you could have 1 foot in this pretty lush green valley, and another foot on the desert sand, which continued from there to the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, just stark. I mean, it just ended suddenly, and that's it. There is no more green for several thousand miles to the west. But the Nile Valley itself is kind of a paradise, in a sense, relative to the desert around it. You know, lush, rich soil, Nile mud deposited by the annual floods and all that sort of thing. You don't leave it lightly. Don't go out into those deserts. Don't go to the Sinai. Now, I'll admit, the Sinai is miraculous. I was out there once with a busload of people, and we came around the corner. There's nothing. There's not a bush, not a blade of grass, nothing, just sun-baked rocks. Came around the corner, and there's an old Bedouin guy with a cooler full of soft drinks that he was selling. I don't know where he came from. Who's the distribution guy that brings those around? I have no idea. So I don't know that people like that were there 1200 BC, but it's amazing what pops up in some of those little wadis and so on. Mike, do you want to offer anything? I should note, by the way, that we're not even near done, and we're
going to have to wrap it up soon.
Yeah,
yes,
we are.
Yeah, let me make just a couple of quick comments in response to Ben, and I'm sorry I keep bouncing in and out here. I'm not sure what's going on with that. I wanted to mention one thing about the plagues is that some of the plagues appear to be directly targeted at the Egyptian worship system.
Yeah,
the first plague turns the water of the Nile River to blood, and we have to understand that the Nile itself was worshipped as a god, as the source of wealth and life for Egypt. And so this miracle demonstrated that the true God had mastery over life and death, and he controlled poverty and prosperity and was superior to any of the presumed Egyptian gods.
The saying was, Egypt is the gift of the Nile.
Egypt is the gift of the Nile.
Yeah.
The second plague is the swarm of frogs, and frogs were seen by Egyptians as symbols of evil spirits. The ninth plague of absolute darkness throughout the land. Egypt, of course, one of the main gods in the Egyptian pantheon is Ra, the sun god, and Pharaoh is seen as the divine son of Amun-Ra. So, you know, these are pretty powerful. These aren't just, you know, God's going through his book and saying, you know, what can I pull out here? These are specifically targeted. And then as far as the numbers go, and Ben was right, I did want to say something about that, is that, yeah, there are some issues with imagining that we've got millions of Israelites leaving and walking out into the desert, not only with food and water and sanitation and all of those issues. And I just wanted to very quickly point people to, if you go to the First Institute manual for the Old Testament, there's a first part and a second part. The first part has an enrichment section. It's enrichment section E, starting on page 192, and it's about the problem of large numbers in the Old Testament. And that's a fairly conservative, theologically speaking, fairly conservative book. In fact, it's probably the most conservative book I probably own on interpreting the Old Testament. And if they're saying in there, yeah, there are some problems with the large numbers, and here's how we can deal with that, I think we can pretty confidently say that it's okay to say that there weren't 3 million Israelites or whatever that came out of Egypt, that it may have been a little bit more limited, maybe around 10 or 20,000. But we have to understand this is not history we're reading as we understand it today, that this is a political and theologically driven history, and it's designed to show the magnificence of God, the true God of the Israelites, and the great wonders that he performed. Regardless of whether it's a few thousand or whether it's 3 million, it still was a miraculous thing.
There have been some people who suggested that the word that's translated as thousand in the 600,000 can also be rendered as clans or
warriors, mighty men.
Yeah, I've seen extended families, so that would bring the number down considerably. But there are some other reasons for rejecting that reading in this particular case. They may simply be inflated numbers designed to show there were lots and lots and lots of them. This is an old technique. I mean, the there's a place I think I mentioned before the same thing in the Book of Mormon. There may not have been as many at the final battle.
Of 10,000 and captain of 10,000. You know,
that may have been an ideal number. You know, like a division is supposed to have, in some cases, 15,000, but might only actually have 4,000 or something like that. You know, right.
Lot of guys named 10,000 that were running around.
right. You know, one thing that I noticed, and it's a kind of repeated thing in the whole Exodus story, is the whining of the Israelites. It's not a really flattering account of them. You know, they get out there, and well, before they even leave, Moses tries to improve their lot, and Pharaoh doubles down on his abuse of them, and they come to Moses and say, you know, what are you doing? You made our life worse. You know, and Moses himself goes to the Lord and says, come on. You know, you sent me here to help them, and it's making it worse. And then, of course, they get out in the wilderness, and they're upset again. You brought us out here to die? And they're going to whine again about the manna, and, you know, eventually they'll be sick of the manna. It's in some ways, kind of a humorous portrayal of the children of Israel, I think, occasionally. But we better move along here.
Just a second to talk about the Passover for just a moment?
Yeah, I think we should do that.
Okay. There's so much that we could talk about with this, but maybe just a few thoughts here is that, first of all, the Feast of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which are part of this ritual that takes place around the same time that Christians celebrate Easter. It's not, by the way, that's not by coincidence. It takes place at the same time because it's on a lunar calendar. They remind Israel that the Lord passed over the houses of the Israelites with that final plague, that the destroying angel would come by, see the blood on the lintels and on the side posts of the doors, and would pass over their house. And so they were to memorialize that every year on their calendar system.
Yeah.
And I think we've lost him again.
We lost him. Well, can I just pick that up? I've led several Passovers. I'm apparently slated to do another one in a few weeks, and I'm not an expert on them by any means. I just follow the Seder, the service that's outlined. But it strikes me that the Passover service is a remarkably powerful, and the story is remarkably powerful foreshadowing of Christ. And it, you know, with the blood of the sacrificed lamb present there on the door, the angel of death passes by. It's the idea, I suppose, that the blood of Christ spares us from the death that we deserve, that would otherwise come to us, the spiritual death. To me, I enjoy doing a Passover service for Latter-day Saints because I think there's so much that can be taught from it and from the story that it commemorates about God's relationship with his people and those he's chosen. Mike, are you there again? Do you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm back. Thank you for picking that up for me. I just wanted to add something as Latter-day Saints. If we look at the end of the Word of Wisdom, section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants, talks about the saints who remember to keep and do these sayings, walking in obedience, shall receive health and wisdom, and run and not be weary, etc. And then that last verse 21, says that the Lord give unto them a promise that the destroying angel shall pass by them as the children of Israel and not slay them.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me that the Word of Wisdom makes this connection with the Passover, and that to Latter-day Saints, the Word of Wisdom has become to us this defining characteristic, at least since the end of plural marriage it has, this defining characteristic of what a real Latter-day Saint is someone who lives the Word of Wisdom, and that it's become, in many ways, as important to us as an outward symbol, a marker to the world of who we are, as the Passover celebration is to a true Jew, to someone who really observes Passover on a yearly basis. So there's some interesting Latter-day Saint connections to that I think are important.
Yeah. Well, you know, you notice that it has to be a firstborn lamb, without blemish, you know, not a bone shall be broken. There's a lot in this that it seems to me is either foreshadowing the crucifixion story, or certainly, I think, in the accounts of the crucifixion is being deliberately echoed. That, the discussion of the Lamb of God, the sacrificed Lamb of God, is drawing on this. And it would have been recognizable, I think, to a Jew familiar with the rituals of the Passover Seder. It's a very, very rich, rich thing. And by the way, it's said thereafter that because the Israelites are spared, in the firstborn, this is the one of the plagues that cannot be explained naturalistically. I mean, I've seen clever attempts, they may be true, you know, to account for what happened with the Nile and the frog and the plague of lice and all that sort of thing because of some volcanic eruption or other. But the thing that's really unnerving about the death of the firstborn is you can't account for that in any way naturally or naturalistically. To single out the firstborn, not take the second son or a daughter, but the firstborn son, and the firstborn son, firstborn offspring of the cattle and all that sort of thing. And at this point, if you didn't realize there's something divine going on, even if you're Pharaoh and arrogant, you recognize it now. You notice this is way beyond my capacity to deal with, and it can't be explained away. The Israelites are commanded to go on and celebrate the Passover forever afterwards. Gosh, we're running so low on time. As we try to not to make these too long, I wanted to mention the beginning of chapter 13. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn, whatsoever openeth the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, it is mine. So thereafter you have sacrifices of the firstborn. And you have to buy, in effect, you have to redeem the firstborn son by making an offering to the Lord for a firstborn son, because he spared the firstborn of Israel. He didn't spare the firstborn of Egypt. And actually, in the story in Luke, for example, where they make an offering for the birth of Jesus in the temple, it's related to this commandment. Firstborn son is sacred unto the Lord or belongs to the Lord in some way. And so in order to keep that firstborn son, you have to make an offering, in effect, buy him from the Lord.
Well, and we also have the overtones with the Levitical priesthood, right?
Yeah.
As a collective offering from the tribes of Israel.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. All right. There's more about the institution of the Passover. Maybe looking at the time, we ought to rush along unless there's something you want to say.
I think probably we're to a point where we should probably wrap it up.
Yeah. Okay, well, I just wanted to say something about the destruction of the of the host of Pharaoh. It's a spectacular story. Of course, the Israelites are caught between the Red Sea at their backs and Pharaoh before them, or vice versa, but they're between a rock and a hard place. And then the way is open for them to cross the sea, showing tremendous power of Jehovah or Yahweh over the elements. They cross as if they were on dry land. And then the hosts of Pharaoh are destroyed. And we don't read it, but in chapter 15 there's the song of Moses and Miriam recites a poem. There's a rabbinic story, though, about the Lord watching their rejoicings on the shore of the opposite bank of the Red Sea and gently rebuking them and saying, don't you understand that the Egyptians too were mine and you're so happy about it, but I'm not, I'm sad. And it's a lesson that that the rabbis tried to insist on, that that in their triumph they should not be too smug, too complacent, too triumphant.
Well, and it's at this point we get that notion that shows up later in the Book of Mormon, right? The Lord is very quick to point out that they, the Israelites, were not necessarily more righteous,
right,
or more deserving than the Egyptians.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes that very, very clear.
They have been, in a sense, chosen, saved by grace. The Lord chose them, gave them a special assignment, but he doesn't love them more. He doesn't value them more. And that's the point of that rabbinic story, which is
the wonderful. We see the same thing in the book of Jonah.
Yeah.
That ends up being the message of Jonah is, you know, you're so upset about this plant that was giving you shade, Jonah, but you wanted me to go out and kill, you know, 100,000 people and animals.
Yeah.
You know, your priorities are really out of whack.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that should never be forgotten, that chosenness may just mean extra obligations, not necessarily greater righteousness. I think we have run out of time. If there's anything else we really need to say, we can say it, but we don't want these to drone on too long, lest we lose our audience. So I'm really grateful. This is a wonderful story, and it's one that is worth reflecting on and that people have reflected on and has been inspired by for several thousand years now. And I regret only that we have to pass it by so quickly. And but we could spend weeks on the story of Exodus, of deliverance, and its symbolic ramifications, its historical links. We just don't have time to do it. But I'd like to thank Mike Parker and Ben McGuire for participating in this, the 63rd Scripture Roundtable of the Interpreter Foundation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.